For those who weren't here yesterday, just a very brief review. What we're talking about is some of the changing cultural and social and economic forces in our country today, especially in the 1970s, which are putting enormous pressure on the basic institutions of family and marriage, and how Christians are responding to this, and how they are trying to preserve those institutions, especially marriage and family and traditional roles of sexual identity, against the many onslaughts and, as I say, tensions and pressures which are emerging, and in a very real sense, that's where most of the action is taking place right now, especially within what we call the evangelical or the born again, evangelical or born again world. Today, I want to broaden that out a little bit because I didn't want to give the impression either yesterday or today or when we talk about changing roles for men. Tomorrow, but it's only the evangelicals. Somebody asked about that, but there's the major thrust and of organization and attention and media concern is with the evangelical movement, and I've spent some time on that. Now, to start right in, then, if that's clear, okay. To start right in, then, what's clear by the spring, the summer, I guess we can say now, of 1978. Is that in the last 10, 15 years, however you want to start the movement, there has been a tremendous change, the only word for it really is revolution, in what we would call sexual attitudes and sexual behavior and sexual norms in this country. And much of the development, and this is the point, is aimed deliberately and sometimes unconsciously, but some of it is deliberate, and I'll talk about that, at the nuclear or the traditional family. Changing laws, changing social norms, patterns, and various areas of behavior, which I want to go through here very briefly for you with this. And there are many people, both in the born again movement and those who are in mainline Christianity and others, such as I'll be talking about with Larry Christensen and Michael Novak, who see the sexual revolution such as we're in, as I'll define here in a minute, as the greatest possible threat really to the stability of our civilization, because they both argue, even though they come from entirely different traditions. Larry comes out of as many of you know, out of a Lutheran tradition, and Michael comes out of a Catholic tradition, and has gone in sort of a different direction. They argue that if the nuclear family goes, there really won't be much basis any longer for the kind of society that we know today, and that the world as we know it might, at least in the Western world, might simply disintegrate. And therefore, what I want to present then are the arguments, the case really, from two somewhat different standpoints. That is, Larry, most of you, when I say Larry Christensen, think of his activity and leadership in the Lutheran Charismatic Renewal Service. And if you want to talk about that, come at 4 o'clock here today. So Larry gets a double header today. But anyway, Larry comes at it from the standpoint of what we would call a revealed religion. That is a religion which has a Holy Scripture, which has been revealed and given to us. And he finds the basis for his defense of the family against the onslaughts which are taking place from Scripture, whereas Novak draws from the Catholic tradition and also from what we call natural religion. That is, that doesn't necessarily have to be revealed, but which is simply natural or instinctive to the human race. If we didn't have organized religion, such as Christianity or Judaism or Hinduism or anything else, we would still have what people would call natural religion. The idea that there's a basic need in all of us for a kind of religious expression and religious organization and a sense of religious order, and that you don't, and Novak's argument, as you'll see, doesn't need the Bible, but it's interesting that they come at it from two different standpoints, and what I want to get at then, you see, is how you can start from two different standpoints and come to the same conclusion, which leads, pretty much to, I think, to the conclusion that the family is really fairly basic. And if anything isn't clear, if I put my foot in my mouth yesterday, like I did yesterday, in talking about mouth to mouth instead of hand to mouth, or word of mouth, or foot in mouth, just let me know, because as I say, I know where I want to get, and sometimes I'm too impatient to get there. Because as much as I really, as we found as yesterday, I'd much rather have a discussion than just simply listening to myself talk. Okay. I think what's just the first of all, then, the sort of three parts here, the reasons for the threats, the dangers to the traditional, the nuclear family as we know it, then what Larry says about it, and what can be done about it briefly, and then what Michael Novak says about it, and then we'll be ready for discussion on this. And I want to go through the sort of the basic factual information very quickly. I'm summarizing my manuscript here because I only have to call to your attention certain developments, and you know what I mean. In the manuscript, I spell these out in some detail and give lots of statistics, but I think I would bore everybody with, you know, lots of statistics with this, and I just won't do that, so won't have any more introduction. We'll plunge right into it. What's happened really is, as an attack on the family, is an increase in certain kinds of behavior, the only words for it which you can call crime and vice, as well as some other things which I want to talk to. And I'll just read here briefly for this. The drastic increase in violent crime in our society, certainly in the last 15, 20 years and continuing on to the present, has a direct impact on family stability. We know of the upswing in both child and wife beating. The crimes of assault and rape on both sexes show no marked decline. So too the strains on family life due to alcoholism and drug abuse are a part of our daily view of the world. Those would be the crimes of violence, beating, assault, rape, and so on with this. And then the problems created with alcoholism, drug abuse, and so on. In the crimes of vice, the pattern really is the same, of increase here, and the increase having a direct threat really to the stability of the family. Soaring increases in prostitution across the country in small towns as well as large. We had a remarkable series in the Minneapolis Tribune this spring on how it's spread into the small towns. It isn't just on Hennepin Avenue any longer, but Minot and various and sort of other places. The soaring increase in prostitution in its many forms, such as massage parlors, rap parlors, and all the rest, tell us much about the condition of marriage, you know, for many people. Allied with prostitution and often controlled by major crime syndicates is the booming industry in pornography, in films, in books. This is the point. In each instance, the result is to debase, depersonalize, or ignore the tenets of morality inherent in traditional monogamous marriage. That is, in each of these cases, what the outcome is a direct threat to those basic tenets or beliefs which we feel are crucial to marriage, such as fidelity, trust, mutuality, affection, and respect. In an allied category, the Bureau of Census reports an enormous increase of illegitimate births in the 1970s. By 1977, one out of seven children were born out of wedlock. That means 14.8% of all mothers were unwed. Now, this statement, however, makes the situation sound as though the woman alone were to blame, an indication that I don't want to make with this. When you say that it's you blame the women, for the increase here, it's unfair or misleading. And of the unwed mothers, nearly one-third were 19 years of age or under. With this, all right. Beyond the impact of crime and vice on the family, Americans have accepted and many have experimented with changing sexual lifestyles or patterns of behavior. The evidence we have here is overwhelming. We have the increasing phenomenon of couples living together without being married. The best estimate being the number has doubled since 1970, and here I do have some statistics, the number has doubled since 1970 from 654,000 to 1.3 million adults, which is a fantastic thing, and that was as of 1977. There is swell-spopping, swinging singles bars and apartment buildings established to encourage the swinging style as glamorized and slick consumer-oriented mass magazines presenting exotic, trouble-free, no-children alternatives to those adults who are stuck with families and mortgages. You'll never see in Playboy or Penthouse or anything else any pictures of children or anything else like that would suggest that there is anything to the world besides cars and exotic parties and fancy fashions and all the rest that goes along with this sort of thing. Other signs of changing family patterns, and when I say these next ones, I don't necessarily mean these critically, but they indicate that there are changing patterns here in family relationships. Other signs are such things as parents without partners has become an accepted way of rearing children. Those divorced or widowed, by comparison to earlier years, feel far less compelled to remarry again, primarily to provide a spouse for the children still at home. Further, many states may have made it easier for fathers to become single parents. rather than perpetuate the older tradition of the mother invariably receiving custody in a divorce. Here's a statistic. In the last 3 years, since 1976, this trend has increased 58%. That is, a father in divorce cases, a father getting sole custody rather than the mother, whereas before this time, it was usually way high in the 90s that in any divorce case, the situation would be that the mother would get custody. It was just automatically assumed on the parts of the courts. But the change has gone over to has increased in 58%. Another comparatively new alternative is to delay having children until one partner has completed her or his education, usually at the graduate level, then limit the number of children to one or two. An increasing number by their own choice and, you know, and not by physical infertility have chosen to have no children. Here we see the full impact of technology's inventiveness with contraceptive devices. Coupled with abortion, this has led the birth rate to drop below zero population growth. Still another alternative to the nuclear family is the world of gays. And I've got a chapter on that somewhere later, and we could talk about that. But you see, what I'm trying to say here briefly with this overview is that what's happening here are things which directly challenge the sanctity and the traditional ideas of what the family should be, and making the glamorous alternatives, which we talked about last time, very appealing to large numbers of people, so that the familiar world of the family seems to be rather dull and simply not with it any longer. All right. Now, in response to this, in the Christian community, we've had a great outpouring of materials on what can be done. One of the best I read just recently is a book by Kenneth Chafin, Is There a Family in the House? He's director of evangelism for the Billy Graham Crusades. And in, I think it was the Memphis Crusade, Billy Graham offers a free book, when he's on television, and this was the one which he offered. And I read, if we have time, I'd like to say a little bit about that a little bit later. But there's been a tremendous increase in interest among Christians in the problem of the family, and I want to talk about sort of the first and still, I suppose, one of the major pace-setting books in what can be done about all this, so far as the Christians are concerned. And that's the book that came out by Bethany Fellowship Press in 1970 of Larry Christensen. He was sort of inspired in a way to write this because he found, when he was in England once, a book written in 1854 entitled Christian Family Life. And if you've read Larry's book, you know that he quotes frequently from this book and then adds his own comments and brings it up to date with this sort of thing. All right. And I'll just go through here in manuscript, reading out of the manuscript, what I say here. And I recognize that by reading from the manuscript, I don't have what educationists call significant eye contact. And I like to have significant eye contact, but I'd rather get it right the first time rather than put my foot in my mouth again, as we do two of this. All right, just this is a summary of Larry's case, and then I'll go into Novak's case, and then we can see what happens. Okay, to Christensen, no institution is more noble nor challenging to the Christian than the family. Though through it, the parents must represent, quote, upon earth, the image of this union between Christ and his church, an image of self-sacrifice, devotion, fidelity, unquote. To human minds, this concept is indeed a great mystery, but it is clearly the intent of biblical teaching. The church cannot survive without the building up of family life. Thus, the latter exists not only for its own benefit, as something that the world teaches, but, quote, to bring glory and honor to God. God has for it a divine structure, a purpose, and a goal. This teaching is best understood as divine order, an order of authority and responsibility which is spelled out in the Bible, based on 1 Corinthians 11:13. The head of every man is Christ, the head of every woman is her husband, the head of Christ is God. Children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord. Once understood, this order of command establishes the authority and rules which will, for believing Christians, protect the family against the evil forces of the world. One of these forces would be disobedience. Christensen points to 1 Corinthians 7:14 as a directive stating, if one but not the other partners desires a sexual experience, the reluctant one is to respond. Concerning divorce, the author argues that no Christian couple should go through with it. They had been married knowing as Christians they were to preserve the stability of marriage as an institution of God. Hence, quote, some people will have to endure an unhappy marriage. The structure of divine order has specific rules for children as well as for mates, wives, and husband. Briefly summarized, they would be, wives are the link between the husband and children. Their role will bring the rest of the family into obedience, as spelled out in Ephesians 5:22-24. the passage about being subject to, about the passage about being subject. And then I have in parentheses here, to which so many people object. The word submission there, however, to the author does not mean servility. He makes a point of differentiating between submission and servility. It means, quote, to yield humble and intelligent obedience to an ordained power or authority. God did not establish his command to humble women, but, quote, for the protection of women and the harmony of the home. Women are thus sheltered from the harsh encounters of life. Marriage is not a 50-50 situation. Each person is 100% himself or herself. Granted, the author acknowledges this divine order does not remain in effect when the husband fails to live up to his duties, but when all is in place, the wife's submission becomes one of the greatest blessings possible to a couple. Christensen says that by their physical and emotional natures, women, men, and men are significantly different. The wife needs protection, freed from the burdens of representing the family outwardly to the community, and, quote, from the emotional attacks of her own children. Most important, she must be protected against spiritual attack from the world of unseen principalities and powers. St. Paul taught that women were vulnerable to the evil of deception, and thus need the protection found, quote, in coming under a man's authority. By this means, Satan's attacks will be repelled. When the husband's orders are wrong or unwise, the wife must tell him so, respectfully but openly. God will see that the correct resolution of any difficulty is achieved. Thus, submission is not servility. With true love, the wife will be, quote, quite prepared and content for him to carry out the final decision. And soon the wife will notice the improvement in her situation. She will no longer have to shoulder financial problems or the worries of the family or lead civic programs or be in charge of raising the children or represent the family to the community. Quote.
You've
got a lot of ground to cover. A lot of ground to cover. Well, scream when I'm done. Quote, this is page 45. A woman is not normally equipped by nature to sustain this kind of psychological and emotional pressure and still fulfill her God-appointed role as wife and mother. Regarding divine order for children, Christensen offers a clear line of authority for their upbringing. They are to obey their parents in all things. Children are assumed to be by nature rebellious, prone to disobedience, and resistant to religious training. Divine order teaches the need for fair-handed but unquestioned discipline. Parents should follow three principles: teach, discipline, and love. Teach the youngsters in the Christian faith. Don't leave this to others or just to the Sunday school. The faith includes traditional values such as truthfulness, modesty, respect for work, and modesty in dress and appearance as insurance against the rise today in sexual misbehavior. Parents must set rules that are fair and enforceable, then enforce them. The rest will take care of itself. The second rule, to discipline, is the most difficult and controversial, I put in parentheses, in divine order. God holds parents accountable for the behavior of their children. Since everyone is a sinner, parents must maintain watchfulness over their own conduct and that of their children. Human nature being what it is, children will understand strict discipline and not parental appeals to some alleged sweetness of character. Christensen makes the application of this specific, quote, the scriptural method of discipline is simple and unequivocal, and he puts in italics, the rod. This is found in Proverbs 13:24, a far better source than current child psychology insights. A spanking is a combination of love and fear, just as God loves and punishes all his children. Parents must not feel guilty over physical punishment. Quote, and this is on Intel. God expects you to spank your children when they rebel or disobey, and it is the father that must do the spanking. After punishment... if you leave out the editorial comments, we can move right ahead here. After punishment, the parent must explain to the child why the punishment took place, how God punishes and then forgives. This is where the third principle, love, enters in. Remember I said teaching, discipline, and love. Rearing children by divine order also includes providing for their happiness and comfort. Love must be expressed freely and openly. God expects nothing less. And Larry has a nice section in there about one day a week in the morning is set aside for hugs, where the family all gets together in bed, and there's a lot of, this going around. And so on. Okay. And then, I keep getting editorial vibrations here. As to God's will for husbands, it is summed up, quote, husbands, obey your wife, sacrifice yourself for her, drawing on Ephesians 5:22 and Colossians 3:20. As Christ rules over the husband as father and made the supreme sacrifice, so too the husband must sacrifice for his family. This means support of the family. To Christensen, that principle is seriously weakened when the wife-mother has outside employment. The burden of such work is too much for the wife. Quote, stronger shoulders are given to the man. He has a greater natural strength of mind to enable him to stand up under the pressures of these cares. That's page 127, 128. Secondly, the husband must be the spiritual provider for the wife and family. He does this by sacrificing himself for them. He shows them what it means to die to oneself, to live for Christ, to let the cross work for them. Beyond this, he treats his wife with delicacy, concern, and respect. To return to my departure point, divine order is based on mutual esteem. And then he goes on with specific examples of this in the second part of the book. But I wanted to bring another argument for maintaining the integrity and the stability of the family to the discussion. And this is by Michael Novak, who started off and almost was ordained, just by way of background, as a Catholic priest, then left the priesthood and became a college professor out of Stanford for some time, then became a freelance writer. Maybe sometimes some of you have seen some of his columns on politics and different things in the editorial pages of newspapers. I don't know, you know, what's in the Seattle Times or different things, but about twice a week he has a piece in, you know, on the Minneapolis Star. And now he's also a teacher at Syracuse, and he's written on a wide variety of subjects. And tonight I'll be using some of his material on another topic. And it's interesting, I didn't realize this until I had prepared this, that I'm not a name dropper. I hate people who drop names, so I'm now going to drop some names. But I went through college all 4 years with Larry. We stayed very close friends. I was his son's advisor in college, and I also happen to know Michael quite well through the Danforth Foundation Fellowship, and have sort of followed his career. And it's interesting to see, just like, you know, your 25th anniversary at college, it's interesting to see what happens to old friends. And both of these have shared similar interests, but come at it from a different standpoint. Now, with Novak, remember, just to repeat, he comes at it not from the standpoint of a revealed religion, that is, of going to the Bible and finding, you know, doctrines and teachings there which are clear and explicit and binding. That's revealed and clear, and that is one tradition within the Christian tradition, which is very, which are very old and well established. Another tradition is the one that Novak uses here, of drawing from natural religion. That is, if you didn't have any revealed religion, how would a society organize itself, and what kinds of institutions would it create, and how would these work out to the best interests of all concerned? And he comes to the conclusion that in a situation where you are guided by natural religion as opposed to a revealed religion, the nuclear family would be the result. And here I want to draw from a remarkably good article. In fact, there was some excerpts from it in the Lutheran Standard not too long ago, some of you probably read this. This was my bibliographical citation here. This was in Harper's in April of 1976. And he is talking about the trend that he finds and doesn't like in modern society, of the opposition to, the hostility to the family, that the family is binding, that the family ties you down, that you're not liberated, that you've got diapers and orthodontists and all the other things that go along with it, and pine top derbies. And if you remember those good old days from Cub Scouts, remember the old pine top derby? I don't know how I survived. Anyway, ours didn't win. Some carpenter did his for his son, and that one won it, which wasn't fair. But anyway, there are lots of people who say that things like the pine top derby, that's Cub Scouts, if some of you don't know what I'm talking about. Things like that simply are much too binding and simply don't open up the opportunities for a full and varied life, such as are available to us in our day of easy mobility and travel and excitement and all the rest that go along with this, as demonstrated by the kind of glamorous life that you see in especially in television. Remember, we talked about that last time. Okay. And I can't read the whole article, it's about 10 pages, but I'll read the highlights here from what Novak says. He says this: we live in lucky times. So many, so varied, and so aggressive are the anti-family sentiments in our society that brave souls may now have, for the first time in centuries, the pleasure of discovering for themselves the importance of the family. Choosing to have a family used to be uninteresting. It is today an act of intelligence and courage. to love family life, to see in family life the most potent moral, intellectual, and political cell in the body politic, is to be marked today as a heretic. That's a very bold statement, but it's a very arresting one. It takes intelligence and courage to have a family today instead of the other way around. All right. Orthodoxy is usually enforced by an economic system. Our own system, post-industrial capitalism, plays an ambivalent role with respect to the family. On the one hand, capitalism demands hard work, competition, sacrifice, saving, and rational decision-making. On the other hand, it stresses liberty and encourages hedonism, or self-pleasure. Now the great corporations, as well as the university, the political professions, the foundations, the great newspapers and publishing empires, and the film industry, diminish the moral and economic importance of the family. They demand travel and frequent change of residence. Teasing the heart with glittering entertainment and gratifying the demands of ambition, they dissolve attachments and loyalties. Husbands and wives live in isolation from one another. Children of the upwardly mobile are almost as abandoned emotionally as the children of the ghetto. The lives of husbands, wives, and children do not mesh, are not engaged, seem merely thrown together. There is enough money, there isn't too much emotional space. It is easier to leave town than to pretend one lives truly, than to pretend that one's lives truly matter to each other. I'll be a little bit unorganized here because I have to do the other thing. Okay. Aggressive sentiments against marriage are usually expressed today in the name of freedom, openness, play, or serious commitment to a career. Marriage is pictured as a form of imprisonment, oppression, boredom, and chafing hindrance. Not all of these accusations are wrong, but the superstition surrounding them is. Marriage is an assault upon the lonely atomic ego. Marriage is a threat to the solitary individual. Marriage does impose grueling, humbling, baffling, and frustrating responsibilities. I remember, if I can interject here, we had one rather pompous young professor at college, and one of the old wise men in the department was pleased when babies came along. He said all Bill needs to do is, you know, do some dirty diapers for a few weeks and that will take care of him. And I think it helped. But that's what he meant by that's what he meant by humbling. Marriage does impose grueling, humbling, baffling, and frustrating responsibilities. Yet if one supposes that precisely such things are the preconditions for true liberation, marriage is not quite the enemy of moral development in adults. Quite the opposite. Okay. The central idea of our fogey way of life, however, seems unambiguous enough. It is that life is solitary and brief, and that its aim is self-fulfillment. Next come belief in establishing the imperium of the self. Total mastery over one's surroundings, control over the disposition of one's times. These are the necessary conditions today for self-fulfillment. Autonomy we understand to mean protection of our inner kingdom, protection around the self, from the intrusions of chance, irrationality, necessity, and other persons. Myself, my castle, he has in parentheses. In such a vision of the self, marriage is merely an alliance. It entails as minimal an abridgment of inner privacy as one partner or the other may allow. Children are not a welcome responsibility, for to have children is, plainly, to cease being a child oneself. For the modern temper, great dreads here arise. Sanity, we think, consists in centering upon the only self one has. Surrender self-control, you surrender happiness. And so we keep the other out. We then maintain our belief in our unselfishness by laboring for humanity, for women, the oppressed, the third world, or for some other needy group. The solitary self needs distant collectives to witness to its altruism. It has a passionate need to love humankind. It cannot give itself to a spouse or children. There is another dominion to this aggressive sentiment, dominated as it is by the image of enlightenment. Ask, enlightenment from what? And the family appears, carrier of tradition, habit, prejudice, confinement, darkness. In this view, the seed of reaction and repression implanted by the family of one's birth, are ready to sprout out as soon as one sets up a family of one's own. With this, okay. And then he gives some long illustrations here, which are good, but just sort of give concrete illustrations of this. And given this sort of diagnosis and this indictment of how our society militates against the family, then Michael comes to these kinds of sort of conclusions as to where he stands on this. A return to the true conditions of our own humanity will entail a return on the part of the least of a dedicated few to the disciplines and terror of marriage and family. Many will resist these disciplines mightily. Not all, of course, are called to marriage. The single life can have its own disciplines, and celibacy its own terrors. What counts is a governing cultural model. The commitment of the family people to the demands of our humanity provide a context within which singleness and even celibacy have a stabilizing strength, and the freedom and dedication of the single, in turn, nourish the family. People say of marriage that it is boring. What they really mean is that it terrifies them. Too many and too deep are its searing revelations, its angers, its rages, its hates, and its loves. They say of marriage that it is deadening, when what they mean is that it drives us beyond adolescent fantasies and romantic dreams. They say of children that they are piranhas, eels, brats, snots, when what they mean is that the importance of parents with respect to the future of their children is now known with greater clarity and exactitude than ever before. Marriage, like every other serious use of one's freedom, is an enormous risk, and one's likelihood of failure is rather high. No tame project, marriage. The raising of children now so that few die in childbirth or infancy, and now that fate takes so little responsibility out of the hands of the affluent and the well-educated parents, brings each of us breathtaking visions of our inadequacy. Fear of freedom, more exactly fear of taking the consequences, adds enormously to the tide of evasion. The army of the night finds eager recruits. He goes on here a little further. My dignity as a human being depends perhaps more on what sort of a husband and parent I am than on any professional work I am called upon to do. My bond to them holds me back, and my wife even more, from many sorts of opportunities. And yet these do not feel like bonds. They are, I know, my liberation. They force me to be a different sort of human being, in a way which I want and need to be forced. Nothing in any case is more poignant and private than one's sense of failing as a father. When my own sense of identity was that of a son, I expected great perfection from my father. Now that I am a father, I have undergone a psychic shift. Blame upon institutions, upon authorities, upon those who carry responsibilities, now seem to be, to me, so cheap. Those who fail on their responsibilities have a new claim upon my sympathies. I know the taste of uncertainty. To be a father rather than a son is to learn the inevitability of failure. And one last quotation here. And as to some kind of solution to the problem which he's diagnosed here. An economic order that would make the family the basic unit of social policy would touch every citizen at the nerve center of daily life. No known form of social organizations weds effect to efficiency in so powerful a way. The family is the primary teacher of moral development. In the struggles and conflicts of marital life, husbands and wife learn the realism and adult practicalities of love. Through the love, stability, discipline, and laughter of parents and siblings, children learn that reality accepts them, welcomes them, invites their willingness to take risks. The family nourishes basic trust. From this springs creativity, psychic energy, social dynamism. If infants are to be injured here, not all the institutions of society can put them back together. Familial arts that took generations to acquire can be lost in a single generation and can disappear for centuries. If the quality of family life deteriorates, there is no quality of life. Again, emphasis on family life is politically important because it can unite people of diverse religious, ethnic, regional, and racial traditions. Families differ in their structures, needs, and traditional inclinations, but they share many basic economic and social, political and social necessities. And he goes on to conclude a little bit further with this sort of thing. So here, I think, are two serious, important reactions to the kinds of developments that are taking place in our life, the kinds of things I mentioned at the beginning and the first third of what I'm talking about. And I simply open it up for your response, reactions, evaluations, what your experience may have been, what, in a sense, we might be able to do about it. I know the first question is always the hardest one, so I should usually have it planted, but I don't have it planted.
It seems to me that the first thing that you read, mm-hmm. was not allowing for any differences in, like one of the things I heard in there was, the husband is supposed to be the financial leader. Mm-hmm. Of the household, and the wife isn't supposed to have any financial worries. Well, I know a lot of cases where I've got very close friends that he decided he was going to take over, and they almost went bankrupt in a month or two because he just has absolutely no aptitude for that. He's a nice guy and does a lot of other things wonderfully, but he forgets to pay the light bill. You know, and it just seems that that point of view doesn't allow, I mean, you know, and that's sort of a ridiculous example of it, but it just doesn't allow for any differences in emotional stability, in interest, in aptitude. And there's got to be girls in the world that are better at some of those areas. You know, I know girls who can fix cars and their husbands who can't drive them across the street, you know, and the other way around. There's all kinds of variations, and I don't see where that allows for any of that variation.
I would think, I can't speak, you know, authoritatively for Larry, but I think he would say that so long as divine order is maintained, where there are aptitudes and skills that don't threaten the basic pattern of order in the family, that something like that, you know, might be agreeable. I don't do the budget. I blow it, but I keep hoping that the pink slip won't come before the end of the month. And Helen took over the budget, and you know, it's fine. But I think I would say that the larger, it's a good concrete example, but I think there would be very room for variation on specifics with that sort of thing. But Larry very, very definitely resists the two-career family.
Back in our day and age, you need the two-career, you need the two-income. You buy a home and have to pay $600 a month to be with every day. They can't make it on one salary anymore.
Then one response to that might be the theme that's been discussed at Holden here too, in a book which is in the bookstore, you know, enough is enough. That maybe something's wrong with one's values if they need to pay that kind of mortgage payment.
Well, it's true, but you see, the pressures of outside, you know, you got to keep up with the Joneses. This is what we see in banking more and more today. They're living beyond their means. They come with applications and have obligations that are so great that it frightens you, and yet they want more.
Yeah, but you see, then to take the other position, somebody has to blow the whistle on that somewhere and say that they have to stop somewhere.
When they do that, then they go to the loan company who give them any kind of money, and then they still plunge further and further. Give me a consolidation loan. I mean, used to be 15 years ago, a $3,000 consolidation loan was large.
Mm-hmm.
Now I need a $15,000 consolidation loan. What have you got for collateral?
Yeah.
I'll pay my bill. Well, they haven't paid it in the past. Mm-hmm. Where do they go from there? Who blows the whistle? We do,
yeah.
But it doesn't do any good.
I would argue from the divine order standpoint then that what is necessary is, you know, as we like to call it, a reassessment of priorities, and that away with this and you get trapped into this. I remember when Carol Henry was talking about this once, he said people would be here and talk to him that they're so far into debt with legitimate things like insurance and stocks and, you know, investments for the future and retirement programs and all the rest, that they can't get out. And they want to, but they're trapped by this sort of thing, and almost all of the things that hold them in are legitimate. It isn't, you know, fancy cruisers or a winter home in Acapulco or something like that. Yeah, that's a very real problem, and Larry has a very specific answer for it. Yeah, over here.
I normally have low blood pressure, but I'm boiling at this point. And I wonder if maybe that wasn't part of your intent.
No.
I don't know about my blood pressure.
No,
but,
because this is a very serious and it's a very widely accepted position. And the book has sold over 1 million copies. Yeah.
I know it is.
And it's Billy Graham has recommended it in, you know, in public.
I think, you know, the first position that was read, that that as long as you accept it, I wasn't here yesterday, but I heard of the hierarchical divine order that you set up, and I've known of it before, that as long as that is assumed to be normative or ideal or whatever, that the first position is defensible. You know, even stuff like, well, the economy demands that we work, you know, two jobs, then you can always say, well, cut back your expectations, blah, 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 blah. And I don't buy that, the divine order hierarchy thing. I think that you have to throw that out if you're going to, you know, allow for any other kind of ordering. well, that's obvious, I guess. But I need to say that I, you know, I think that the problem with that position is not the economy or anything else, but that that hierarchical structure that's assumed to be God-given and the only one allowable, and I don't believe that.
Is it just you don't want to believe it, or, you know, from a defense, you know, hermeneutics? I mean, if the Bible says this, then isn't that what we're supposed to do?
I don't believe that the Bible says that.
Somebody come to my aid here or assistance?
Well, the Bible says, you know, wives be subject unto your husband, but the thing that we forget to read is the verse that goes before that, that says that the husband is to be a Christ, you know, and not, you know, and to be subject to the church as Christ was subject to his Father. And we forget to, you know, we always read about wives be subject to your husband and children be subject to the parents, but we forget to read the initial responsibility of that. And as I read it, it says, okay, you know, maybe there's at some time some order in that, you know, that but that essentially we are all subject to Christ and the church, and we are each responsible. I cannot save my husband or my children, nor can they save me. I have to do that on my own. I have to be subject to Christ and God first, and the rest of it will then fall into place, and God in his way will show our unit what the way to go is. And maybe at one time it's for my husband to make the decisions and be the leader, and maybe at some other time it is necessary for me, or maybe, you know, at another point in time for my children to make decisions for me.
Are you assuming therefore that the husband can be a Christ? I think that can't happen.
No, I'm saying that that's a very, you know, that's a tough position. That's what the Bible tells us to work for.
Well, that's one thing the Bible says, and I think there are other things. But
yeah.
I look at that segment as a circular argument, not a linear one. That it looks at the relationship between God and Christ, and the husband and the wife, and God and Christ, in a circular relationship instead of a hierarchical one. I resent the hierarchical mode. I also resent the blackness with which you drew the initial picture of sexual immorality, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I firmly believe that with Kinsey, that nothing has really happened since my grandmother in the early 1900s. I also, I think the word that's been missing today is the word choice. I think right now, with technology and with a lot of other things, there are many more viable choices than ever before.
I agree.
And in that, then, there goes also more of a risk.
Yeah.
I agree completely with you that the American family is the absolute, you know, basis of everything. And on the other hand, I have chosen to go to graduate school. I take this all very personally. There is nothing I would like more than a home and family and, you know, to be living at a college. And that has not yet happened in my life, and I refuse to wait until it does, to take a passive stance. And I prefer to take an aggressive one, and that is to educate myself. And to say, well, you know, I've got a lot of options open, and I really wonder what's going to happen with my life. I also think that, you know, the world is not going to hell in a handbasket. I really don't. I don't think there's anything new in prostitution or new in pornography. I think perhaps we're more aware of it than we are isolated from it.
I think you can document that. Accessibility to pornography and to prostitution is much more readily accessible now than it ever has been before.
I grew up in a seaport town, and so, you know, perhaps that's something. I also feel a little bit in the dark battling with statistics, because those arguments are difficult for me. Statistics can say most anything one would like them to say.
Yeah.
And I
But I do feel a concern to answer compassionately people who do feel that the world is going to hell in a handbasket, and therefore I've got to cling to these structures. But I personally choose not to.
Oh, Doris.
One of the happiest families I know, both the mother and father are teach in med school. They're both professional doctors. They have children.
Yeah.
A very, very wholesome family life. They're church people. And they're extremely happy and self-fulfilled.
So
I just feel that there is that possibility where a wife, especially a woman who is extremely brilliant, has to have something to fulfill herself outside of keeping house.
That really brings up the whole key is when we're, each of us seeks our identity. And while we're struggling to seek our identity, we do that through whatever means is available. And all of us, male or female, go through a period of trying to say, who am I? And at the point where we are affirmed because God made us and we have value, real value because we are God's children, at that point, then we can become less defensive about who we are and be more open to our role in God's kingdom. And it seems to me that this is one of the basic conflict in the discussion here. The comment there was that the people were self-fulfilled. Well, maybe they were fulfilled, that they really had come to understand their place in God. And not that they had necessarily done it on their own, but that they had come to grips with that. And I think this is a very, the teenage conflict is the same thing. It's that struggle to know, who am I? Women at the same point in history now are struggling with, who am I? And but once you establish that you have validity and you have value because of God's love for you, that really frees then to look at how you go about developing the family or whatever. But as far as for me to talk to a woman, I'm really you said it was brave and took courage at this point to choose to have a family. I think it takes courage to lead a discussion like this.
Well, I think I told you, maybe I mentioned it when I made up the out table of contents, Phyllis Schlafly and Anita Bryant and Maribel Morgan and Gothard and Schuller and others, and my daughter subtitled this, Things Dad Doesn't Like About Religion in America Today. but that's, to me, this is what Holden is all about. And I'm not always the devil's advocate. Right, but I like your idea that first there has to be the self-acceptance. It has to be basic to this. And if in a family this can be established from the beginning and nourished, it's the most beautiful gift that's available. But there are these kinds of pressures, and on this thing, I mean, there are the things of violence. Really, I think are damaging. I don't think there's more sin. I didn't mean to give the impression that there's more sin today than there ever has been before, but it's so much more readily accessible. If any of you, read, I don't know about the Seattle paper, but we had a legitimate but fascinating controversy in the Minneapolis papers over whether or not to allow the advertising for the massage parlors to be in the paper. Freedom of the press versus the fact that these were obviously fronts for houses of prostitution. And the Ministerial Association, Catholic and Protestant and Jewish, took a stand that dial a blonde with a, and all this sort of thing, magic fingers and all the rest, should be eliminated because that is contributing to the crime, because we know that the syndicate, it's the Alexander Brothers, if you're familiar with Minneapolis, we know it's the Alexander brothers who own the stuff down at 9th and Hennepin and on Lake and everything. are in control, and they're controlled by the mafia. And therefore, the paper was contributing to crime, you see, by publishing just the ads. They didn't have anything more than just the name. And then, on the other hand, the person says, well, I've got a business, I've got a legitimate right to advertise. And who are this minister, if you allow the ministerial association to tell you that they can do this, pretty soon, you know, some other pressure group will tell you you can't do something else. And but that's the point I'm going to try and say. Never that there's less or there's more sin. It's just that right. Well, I'll give you a good example. When I was in high school, one of the annual coming of age rituals in Minnesota is go to the state high school basketball tournament. You know, you save up and you wear your hero jacket. You know, and there's Belle Plaine and Elbow Lake and, you know, and all of them, you know. And we were down on Hennepin. Are you Elbow Lake?
Belle Plaine.
Belle Plaine, okay. I mentioned the one that I was all impressed because we only had one letter, but BP, that was extra, you know, because you had more stuff on your jacket and so on. But we got the Shinders, which is one of the outlets, and the most risque book we could buy was Erskine Caldwell's God's Little Acre. And I remember we were in the old, what was it, it's a hotel that used to be on 11th and Nicholas, it's gone now. But anyway, we were reading, and we were, there was some boys from Tracy in the room next to us, and all of a sudden, about 2 in the morning, pounding on the wall, boy, have you got the page 48 yet? You know? And, you know, that was it. I mean, that was what was available. Now we can go to any place, you know, on Hennepin Avenue from 12th down, and the most, you know, the most perverse things are, you know, just explicit. They're right there. That's the sort of thing. I mean, that just wasn't available before, and it's done in the name of, you know, of the freedom of expression. And what one man's meat is another man's poison. I know that particular thing. And there's this very basic conflict that's going on. And isn't there a case in Florida now where parents are suing a television station because the son saw, is it San Francisco?
San Francisco.
Yeah. That's the sort of thing that I'm, you know, see, I'm trying to suggest, yeah.
Well, I was just going to get back to the Larry Christensen's book.
Yeah.
I read it when I was in my middle 30s, and my family were on their way to being raised, and my question was, and my argument would be, I had many arguments with him, but the one that was just so obvious, I don't think I finished the book, was what do you do? With this Christian family, when your Christian family is grown, where does that leave the wife with absolutely nothing to fill 40 years of her life? And I've seen so many people have that happen to them, people my age, and I was a girl that got married right after high school, did not have a career, and by the grace of God, I've been given a career in 2 years, and have had my role changed completely, but I have so many friends who haven't had that happen to them, and who are in mental
wow. Well, very, very much so. No question there. And the church is just now beginning to develop a ministry for singles. And it's just
very gracious to women with careers, frankly.
Yeah.
Even women with careers in the church, where mine is.
Well, in the Lutheran church, has settled the, I mean, LCA and ALC have settled the ordination question. So we don't have to discuss that one. Episcopalians are still hung up on it.
They have settled the ordination question, but they certainly have not backed up.
Practice,
their,
no. There are 17, in the ALC, there are 17 women who are ordained who have calls.
And there are Nancy, many more than yeah. that in the seminary.
Yeah, waiting.
Who
yeah.
are honestly and earnestly preparing
right.
for
yeah.
that.
Right, yeah, I grant you that.
There's one other trap in this whole train of thinking, and that is the whole search for self-fulfillment. That somewhere in there, there comes a decision whether to remain turned inward or to accept the fact of basic unfulfillment and be able to reach out to other people. And I think this is one place that the church can really sound that loudly, that it's okay to be unfulfilled.
Yeah. That in terms of marriage, I mean.
In terms of life.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of anyone, in any situation. Did you see the NBC documentary on Marin County?
Yeah, well, I read
it all now, and I think that falls along now.
Okay, I read the serial one, and it was good fun. But some others, yeah.
Yeah.
Can
well,
we?
Another thing I think is, you know, that the Bible also tells us that we're to use our talents. We're to use those God-given things, and I think that we all, and you know, I know a lot of fellas who have
a talent for nurturing, a talent, you know, you look around at the faculty and you can see some here who have a talent for nurturing and caring and loving. And up until recently, we haven't allowed men to have that nurturing kind of experience in our society, or if they chose to do it, everybody said, boy, what's with him?
You mean like a nurse, for instance?
Yeah, nurses, or even, you know, sometimes situations where men have chosen to stay home with their family and do some of those family-oriented kinds of things, and the wife has chosen to do something else. Or maybe it's necessary for that man to do it because he's a widower or whatever. And boy, we, you know, always said, boy, you know, you must be a little weird. And, you know, as well as what we've done to women who've chosen to add something to their nurturing role. And I think it's really important that we remember that we all have God-given talents and that we need to seek those out. And that's part of self-fulfillment, as I see it, is determining what our God-given talents are and then putting them to work, either, you know, in a home, in society, wherever that role is.
Anything from the balcony? Yeah.
Most of this has been centered around the Christensen mm-hmm. aspect, and I guess I'd like to explore a little more what Novak is saying. One of the things that I see, I guess, is the problem we have with intimacy. That what's in trouble today is not necessarily marriage, but that even living together is in trouble because of the lack of capacity for intimacy.
And because the trend is towards what Tom Wolfe calls the me decade. I gave a lecture on this last week. The self-help thing, of, you know, I gotta be me. What's the other one? I did it my way. I've got to do it my way. Is that what you're referring to?
Well,
and what Novak is arguing, you see, is that the family can, the living in the family experience can bring us out of that, and that's to realize our full humanity when you have to care and concern and go through the agonies and the struggles with the family and learn to, you know, to survive. And a lot of people are choosing, because of the affluence and the glamour and all the rest that goes with it, a hedonistic lifestyle. Remember the whole thing that Hugh Hefner was doing in Playboy for a long time on this sort of thing, that you have no responsibility to anybody beyond yourself. And what Novak is arguing, not in terms of revealed religion, but simply in terms of human relations, that's what is destructive of humaneness. I didn't quite see your follow-up, where you were going with it.
Well, I guess I wanted you to follow up.
Oh, okay. That's what I'm not getting paid for, but that's what I'm here for.
I think he puts his emphasis, love, discipline, and teaching. Is that the three?
Mm-hmm.
No, love was the last one.
Yeah.
First Corinthians 13.
No, teaching, discipline, and love.
Yeah, but First Corinthians 13, the last verse says, now abides faith, hope, love, and the greatest of these is love.
Yeah.
I put love first. Discipline second, I think, and then teaching.
Well, it's, you know, you can argue that that's a sort of a chicken and egg argument. That you have to teach them first so they know something, and then assuming, you know, that they'll go wrong, there has to be discipline, but the forgiveness has to come after the discipline.
I think you love them first.
Why, I do. Why?
Children or women?
Children.
I hope that she saves all these discipline things till Papa comes home so he can be the bad guy. Yeah. Because I can go with bad. He can go with bad.
The father should say and the parent explain.
Yeah, but I don't go save the discipline till Papa comes home. Yeah.
That's,
go
that's your Papa.
I know that's the way I was raised. Very, very much. And we all always had this one advantage. For the parents in a small town was that the store, my father had a hardware store, was only two blocks away. And the threat for shaping, getting us shaped up was to call 8-0. That's all we had for our number in those days. And, you know, if I didn't get shaped up, you know, she would pick up the receiver and say 8-0. I didn't realize she'd held her hand down on the you know, on the other thing. But Father did it, and we learned, in Larry's point, is that we learn who's in charge, and that there isn't any doubt, you know, about who's responsible for the discipline on him. But the point there rests, you see, on his psychology of women, or feminist, not feminist, but feminine psychology, that women are by nature less. How should I say this? Less strong, and therefore weaker sex. Yeah.
Simple.
Yes.
Why can't we just lay to rest in the passage in Ephesians? I mean, why do we have to take that literally when we don't take it literally when Paul says for women not to speak in church? Obviously, we don't pay any attention to that anymore. Why should we pay attention to that passage? I mean, it's so culturally conditioned.
Yeah.
How could Paul really say differently?
Okay. The book on that to read, and it's in the bookstore because it's a long, complicated argument, and it gets into the field of hermeneutics. What method you choose to do? I don't want to, you know, get off too far into research, but this led to a real crisis in the evangelical movement, because if you say that's the case, that Paul was so culturally conditioned that he had this hostility really towards women, and that therefore we should ignore that, then you're really saying that Paul was wrong. And when you're saying Paul was wrong, then you're saying that the scripture was wrong. And that led...
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, we've already said that.
Yeah, well I was going to say that in the evangelical world, this led to a very famous book. Harold Enzell, the editor of Christianity Today, came out very angry because Fuller Theological Seminary was teaching this. Paul Jewett's book about God, male or female, and giving the more liberal interpretation, and Lindzel was so mad that he wrote a book called The Battle for the Bible, which is, you know, created a tremendous furor within evangelical circles today over this, and the husband-wife or the family relationship thing has opened up into the larger issue then of hermeneutics. And the only way I can answer that is with hermeneutics, you either finally come down to inerrancy on the one hand or the historical critical method on the other hand, and you can't sort of really sort of have a combination of both, both ways of doing this sort of thing. Because in the inerrancy argument, it's put forward, if there's one error in the Bible, then it could all be wrong. You know, the camel's nose in the tent argument. And that therefore, you have to hold the line, you see, on everything. And this raises all kinds of very difficult questions, and many people are you know, very seriously bothered by this. And the argument goes forward in lots of different places. Christianity Today, Reformed Journal, and some of the others, where this battle is still very much alive. And I, Maynard was talking to me, the bus driver, about the inerrancy versus historical critical method, and I can only conclude that, you know, you choose the method which seems to you to be the closest to, you know, to reality. Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking about all these things. I thought so often about... you know, my own role and my own place and what will happen in the future and sharing my family and myself. And I've come to this conclusion that I can just get myself in a ball over, you know, just all wound up over these issues. And that my only hope is that Christ and my Heavenly Father is alive and well and acting in my life if I am open. And that all of these concerns are, He is aware of. Therefore, you know, I can trust that these workings out will be in His will if I, you know, am open and trust in His will for my life. So I can rest it there, and He knows my needs and the needs of my husband and family. You know, what can I do?
But choices have to be made, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, for instance, several years ago, my telephone started ringing, and people started asking me to teach their children. Now, I had been prepared for this, but this had not, I had not thought of doing this or anything, but it just started happening because the Lord, you know, was preparing it.
Okay. I think time's almost up. Does anybody else, does somebody have a good conclusion? I could wrap it up, but yeah.
How much of the time
are
you playing devil's advocate?
I'll tell you about that afterwards. No, I'll say this straight out. My wife went to work, and this sounds like I'm a slave driver, but my wife went to work 4 days after we were married. And we didn't even make Dayton's white sale, you know, before she went to work. And that's an inside joke from Minneapolis. But
bargain basement.
Where were you in your education when you got married?
I was finishing graduate school. Yeah. And I have no problems with
doctors.
And I have no problems theoretically with the two career families. With this, and what happened was, when I was interviewing Larry for the Bold in the Spirit book, I hadn't read The Christian Family, and we were in the Curtis Hotel where all ALC conventions are centered in the Twin Cities, right? And Larry noticed, and we were talking, and then they asked about me, and I went on to explain that my wife had gone on for a PhD, and how pleased, you know, and happy, and all this, and so we'd been going along very, you know, very openly and freely, and all of a sudden there was dead silence. And they were too polite to criticize me or disagree with me, and I've got it on tape. We had talked a lot about the charismatic movement. I was interviewing them about specifics about the conference. This was, you know, the Curtis was right next to the, you know, and everything else. And I talked to a lot of people in his congregation. I interviewed a lot of people at San Pedro. And they were very happy, genuinely happy with the situation that prevailed there. And time and again, they told me this. This was the case.
Does Larry make this work in his own family? Does he make this work in his own family?
Yes. Yes, I've known Tim, and then there's a second child now, what's her name, at St. Olaf. I watched him all the way through. 4 years as his advisor, and
I haven't really seen any family that I would say is an example of making that decision.
I've seen some split up over it.
I could.
And those children are grown now.
Well, no, the oldest one, Tim is out. He's in the Marine Corps right now.
Now, what's she going to do when they all?
Yeah, that's the unanswered question, right?
Educated and a bright person.
Yes, yes, very much so.
Or, you know, what happens to that, you know, we asked the question yesterday when we were talking about women, but the same thing is when you talk about the family. What happens when, you know, as happens in this world a lot, the husband dies,
mm-hmm.
you know, and this wife who has put all of her effort toward supporting that top role and nurturing this family is suddenly stuck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with a bad situation.
I don't even dare mention Larry's answer to that.
Well, I
get married again.
No, well, that's one. And if you read the probably a better book on this than Larry's is one which is written by a woman, Elizabeth Elliot, Let Me Be a Woman. I don't know if any of you know that one, but she adheres strongly to the divine order position. And maybe readers would pick up better vibes from Elliot than they would from Larry on this. Yeah, she lost two husbands. Died in by accident or sudden death. One first one was a missionary and the second one was a teacher, right. Yeah, and she's married again and she writes for Eternity and Christian Herald and that sort of thing. With this, I was trying to... Yeah, but she stays... Yeah, but she stays...
There's no reason why you can't... Oh, yeah, I wouldn't say that necessarily. And if you look at it Tuesday as a... president, vice president sort of thing. Well, what happens with the vice president if the president of the company moves on or something like that?
Well,
the responsibility of the leader is to prepare the other one as well. It's not a submersion
yeah.
or anything like that. It's a development.
Yeah, that was, I can just, with a closing example to that, for my own family, when my father died, you know, unexpectedly, quickly from a heart attack, my mother had never made a bank deposit, and she'd never had the gas tank filled by herself and everything else. And there were some real problems, and she became accident prone as a call for attention because she needed help, and she didn't know how to do all these things. And she had been, you know, she'd been shielded and protected.
Would it have been better if she had shared in the beginning?
But why can't that can take place with the head? And that may be a part of the responsibility
yeah.
of the head.
And that's... I tried 5 minutes ago to, you know, to get out of here because...
do it all.
Tomorrow we'll have to talk about changing roles for men. So...
Oh. Later.